Everyone knows Law Matters was created to open the lines of communication between law enforcement and the community. Over the course of the last year, we have become painfully aware of the very negative headlines national media projected across the country regarding all law enforcement agencies. Over the last several months, and after numerous investigations, we have learned that these negative headlines did not tell the whole story, but rather painted a picture designed to diminish the rule of law and those whose job it is to enforce it. Law Matters wants you to hear all the facts so you can decide for yourself. As these investigations conclude, these stories will be featured on our Truth Matters page on lawmatters1030.org website. Now, let's start the show. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is ATF Special Agent in Charge, Iber. How you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And he doesn't want us to say this, but PIO Cody Monday is here as well. So, told you, I was throwing you under the bus. I want to hear about you. I want to hear about your history. What got you involved with law enforcement?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story because I'm told I'm kind of an anomaly here, but I always knew I wanted to be in law enforcement since I was a little kid. And I don't know if that's growing up watching the show Chips, you know, if you remember that one or not. But there's pictures of me in my, you know, as a young man or a young boy, I should say, in, you know, police outfit and running around with, you know, helmets and badges and things like that. And,
giving tickets to your friends.
Yeah, right. My parents. You know, so it was something that I always wanted to do, and I knew this was the career path that I wanted to take. So, you know, unlike it seems like a lot of people I come across that say they didn't know what they wanted to do till later on in life, I knew this was something I always wanted to be involved with. So
why ATF?
So that's another interesting question. So when I was in college, I was looking to do an internship. I had criminal justice, was getting my degree in criminal justice, and ATF was one of those agencies that had internships available. And growing up where I did, outside of Dallas, Texas, all I knew about ATF was Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing. And so I went in, did an internship with them, and it was eye-opening. It truly opened my eyes to what ATF really does. And I got to meet some fantastic people, some people that were in Waco, some people that were there at the Oklahoma City bombing, and some other fantastic agents, and I was kind of hooked. So,
you know, I think that's, ATF has a mystery as far as the public's concerned. They're like, okay, ATF, what do they do? But some of those incidents that you're talking about, unless you hear the inside story of what was going on, you're listening to the news, it's very misleading. I don't know if you can address that, but, you know, I always thought, well, wow, why would they do that at Waco? And after I heard the inside story, I'm going, wow, why didn't they do it sooner?
Yeah, you know, there was mistakes made in Waco, you know, and what we've learned about. Obviously, I wasn't an agent then. I was in high school when that went down. It was actually just the 30th anniversary for Waco. Or was it the Oklahoma City bombing? No, it was Waco. And Oklahoma City bombing was two years after that. But anyways, I apologize. There is, and like I said, we made some mistakes, and it changed our agency. It changed the way we do our planning and things for operations. And but there was a lot going on there. You know, there was a lot going on there that it needed to be addressed.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So, what is the main mission of ATF? And tell people what ATF stands for.
Yeah, so ATF is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. We're under the United States Department of Justice. And that's, you know, we are responsible for the federal, and we're the federal law enforcement arm for federal alcohol, tobacco, firearms, explosives, and arson laws. You know, but if you want to break it down even more, you know, the majority of our cases fall under the illegal possession and the illegal trafficking of firearms. We also have the explosive side and arson side. The alcohol and tobacco kind of brings us back to our roots, you know, during the Prohibition era and Elliot Ness and things. And there's still diversion that goes on with those. But the majority of our cases are... we're looking at the illegal possession and the the firearms trafficking that occurs.
Can you, so that is your mission? Just yes, basically, that's the mission of what you do.
Yeah.
Was it always and explosives?
We always had the explosives element.
Because I was looking at ATF and then it says and explosives. I thought they could have been named FATE instead of ATF.
Well, we're one of those three-letter agencies, so after...
You had to keep it to three letters. It's required.
I wasn't the one making that decision at the time, but that was, you know, we used to be under the Department of Treasury, and then after 9/11, we were shifted under the Department of Justice, and that's when the silent E came in, you know, but we were always working explosives prior to that.
What's your career history? Where have you been? What have you done?
Sure. So if we go back, I did my internship in college, and ATF was not hiring at the time when I graduated. And probably some of the best advice they ever got from an ATF agent was go be a local police officer. So that's what I did. And I was a local police officer in a town called Carrollton, Texas, which borders the north part of Dallas for a little over 3 years. And then ATF called and said, congratulations, we want to hire you, and you're going to Phoenix, Arizona. I said, well, Phoenix, Arizona, oh my goodness, what is in Phoenix, Arizona? You know, when you get hired on with ATF, they give you a list of cities, preferable cities that you want. Phoenix, Arizona was about 1,000 miles away from the closest city I put on that list. So I was a little confused about what was going on, and it was, you know, it was kind of interesting. The lady said, hey, you know, there's 3,000 other people that want your job, so take it or leave it. I said, no, ma'am, I'm taking it, you know, and packed up my U-Haul, you know, and came out to Phoenix. And I spent about 10 years here in Phoenix as an agent, and then promoted. And my first supervisor position was in Oklahoma City. And then from Oklahoma City, I went out to our academy. I was the branch chief running over our basic training programs.
Where's your academy?
It's in Glencoe, Georgia, at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So it's about an hour south of Jackson. An hour south of Savannah, Georgia, an hour north of Jacksonville, Florida, right on the coast there.
Okay.
And then from there, I promoted again to the assistant special agent in charge, where 4.5 years was in Chicago, Illinois.
Yay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful city. And then after that, and then in May of last year, I would. Became the special agent in charge back here in Phoenix for the Phoenix Field Division.
So you like it? You like being in Arizona?
I love it.
Okay.
You know, I got to be honest with you. It was the Chicago winters were getting a little brutal for me. You know, that's the farthest north I've ever lived in my life. If you know,
and you're right on the lake, so that makes it worse.
Oh yeah. You know, so I'm loving it here. I'm loving it here.
You've all thawed out and everything?
Oh, yeah. My blood has thinned, you know. It's when it hits 60 or 50s, I'm like, what's going on? I need a coat or something.
I know. People in Chicago think I'm nuts. It's like, oh, my God, it's 60 degrees. I take out a parka.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about some of the things that you guys do. Let's talk about gun trafficking, because that seems to be a big thing.
It's a very big thing, especially here in Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, firearms are interesting. You know, firearms are not like narcotics, where, you know, your methamphetamines, your fentanyl, which is the big topic now, is, you know, your cocaine is illegal in and of itself just to possess it. Firearms are not. So where we get in is how, at what point in time does that gun go from legal commerce into illegal commerce? And so that's where it starts. And firearms trafficking truly starts, a lot of it is straw purchasing. And straw purchasing is when an individual goes into a gun store, a federal firearms licensee, and purchases a firearm that, say, it's for themselves, when in fact it is not for themselves. Someone else has asked them to purchase the firearm or is paying them to purchase this firearm, and that's where the trafficking starts. And then, you know, it's not just one firearm. It is...
carload.
Well, it can be carloads, and it can be a bunch of firearms. And ammunition is the same thing. And so, you know, and that's firearms trafficking. And we talk about firearms trafficking here in Arizona, but there's kind of three aspects to it. There's international firearms trafficking, which we see on the news a lot. These A lot of firearms are going to Mexico. You have firearms that are going to other states where they may have stricter state laws. So you have trafficking there. And then you also have domestic trafficking. And domestic trafficking, you can look at it as when we have these individuals that are prohibited from possessing firearms, your felons in possession and people like that. How did they get the firearm in the first place? They got it somehow. Did someone buy it on their behalf? You know, there's different ways that they come across these things. Was it stolen out of a burglary of a vehicle or an FFL? So there's trafficking. There's domestic trafficking as well.
Okay, you said FFL.
I'm sorry.
What it means.
Yes, federal firearms licensee. It is a gun store. Yep, you gotta keep. If I keep using these acronyms. Yes, then just stop me and I'll clarify that.
Okay, you said state laws. Sure. All state laws aren't the same when it comes to gun ownership, right?
No, correct. They're not.
Would your job be easier if they were?
I don't know if it'd be easier, to be honest with you, because you're still going to have firearms trafficking. You're still going to have individuals acquiring firearms that cannot possess them. And, you know, unfortunately for this criminal element that's going about acquiring these things, if they would put their ingenuity into legitimate business or legitimate things, they would probably be millionaires. And so, you know, it's always, they're always coming up with new ways to acquire these firearms. So I don't know if the state laws, if they were the same, would make our job easier, because we don't enforce state laws either. It's federal firearms laws that we enforce, and those are the same throughout the United States.
Well, Arizona, you don't have to have a permit to carry a gun to own a gun, right?
Sure.
So it just makes sense that if you're going to own a gun, like driving a car, you have to go get a license, learn how to do it. Why wouldn't they make it so you have to learn how to use this thing before you buy it? You have to qualify.
Well, that's not for me to decide.
Wouldn't it be easier if that was part of the process?
You know, I would say this. I would say that if people want to purchase firearms and own firearms, they should be familiar with those items that they're purchasing. You know, just like anything else you would purchase, you want to be familiar with it and be comfortable with using it. And firearms, you know, is not like a TV. When you buy a new TV and you're trying to find channels and things, there's actually, you know, there's some deadly consequences that could happen if they're not used properly. And when they are used properly, there are deadly consequences as well, but hopefully those are justified.
Explain what ghost guns are. We hear that a lot in the news, and it's like, okay, what is it?
Yeah, so ghost guns are... that's they're privately made firearms. PMFs is what we refer to them as. And ghost guns is just, you know, a nickname for these privately made firearms. And basically what happens is there's no serial numbers. There's no manufacturer imprinted on these frames or receivers of these firearms. And so it makes it very hard for us to trace these firearms when they're recovered in crimes. Now, if you're a private citizen, you can make your own firearm, and you don't have to serialize it. You don't have to put any markings on it if it's you're making it for yourself and for you. It's when we had companies that are they send out these buy build shoot kits, and it's basically a combination of parts, and all you got to do is kind of put them together and mill them out. There's a little bit more to it, but ATF has determined that those need to be serialized before they're put out, because now you're in the business of manufacturing firearms for the most part. Now, like I said, individuals can make their own. They don't have to serialize them. There's nothing that goes along with it. But when you get into the business of actually manufacturing these things for profit and for livelihood, well, then you have to follow the guidelines and the rules and the laws that are set up.
It'd be like buying a car that didn't have a VIN number.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah.
And that's where, you know, firearms tracing is a big a big tool that law enforcement uses, not only ATF, but all of our other federal, state, and local partners, is when these firearms are recovered in crimes and we trace them, then we can start figuring out how did it get from legal commerce into illegal. When was that? When did that happen? Yeah, but if we can't trace them, we don't know who the first original purchaser was.
So these kits that are sold, can, if a gun like that is used in a crime, can that person who manufactured that kit be held accountable because he didn't put a number on it?
Yeah, if we determine that they're manufacturing these things for their business. So these companies were making these buy, build, shoot kits. Now they are required to get a federal firearms license, an FFL, a manufacturing, and serialize those things before they send them out.
Okay.
And so that ruling changed late last year. I want to say it was late last year, and hopefully Cody can. I believe it was 2022 in November.
But,
and so now those are required to get serialized. And then if an individual had one of these privately made firearms prior to this ruling, there's no requirement to serialize those. But if they bring it into a federal firearms licensee or something to get worked on, to get repaired or whatever, then that federal firearms licensee is then required to stamp a serial number on there.
Oh.
Yeah, that was part of the new ruling.
Oh, that's cool. And if they don't, they're in deep doo-doo?
Well, they're in violation.
But how would you know?
Well.
Yeah. Never mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm looking at this list here, and in this NIBIN, tell me what this is about.
Sure. NIBIN stands for National Integrated Ballistic Information Network. And NIBIN is... Every firearm, when fired, leaves distinctive marks, kind of like a fingerprint.
Okay.
That is unique in and of itself to that firearm, where the ejector, you have ejector marks, you have where the firing pin strikes the brass of the bullet, of the casing there. And so each one of those, like I said, each firearm has its own distinctive fingerprint. And so when these shell casings are recovered from a scene, we can then start linking crimes. So let's say a shooting happened in Flagstaff, Arizona, and all they had were shell casings at the scene. Well, you could pick up the shell casing, you put them in this system, this National Integrated Ballistic Information Network system, NIBIN, and then let's say there was a shooting in Phoenix with the same firearm. When those shell casings are recovered, you put those into the system as well. They talk, and then you can link the crimes. This firearm was used not only in Flagstaff, but in Phoenix. And then when you recover the firearm, you do a test fire of that firearm, your crime guns, when they're recovered, and you put them into the system as well. And then you have the firearm that was used to commit the crime up in Flagstaff, to commit the crime in Phoenix. And then we can start working on who possessed that firearm if we don't know already, and how that firearm got into the hands of this individual.
How do you find people? How do you hunt them down? It's a big country.
It's a huge country, and we can't do it ourselves. And that's why, you know, law enforcement across the nation, and you see it, is how do we combat violent gun crime? How do we do it? And so, you know, there's plenty of different tools, and NIBIN is just one tool in that entire investigative process to figure out who done it.
Yeah. It's a national thing.
Yes, ma'am.
So you can have somebody committing a crime in New York and they're living in California now and they commit a crime there. You can go, oh, you did that.
Correct. And just because, you know, and that's where it gets tricky. Just because the firearm was used in two different places doesn't mean the person that ultimately possessed it when you catch the person with the firearm was the one that did those different shootings. Because firearms change hands all the time, especially in the criminal element. They are constantly looking to
swap
guns. Firearms to get rid of them, to use them to barter for narcotics or whatever. Or when they use them in a crime, they know they need to get rid of it because they don't want to get caught with that firearm. So, you know, that's where the investigation truly starts, is how do you put all those pieces together. And so NIBIN is just one tool in that entire investigative process.
Wow. Okay, that sounds really complicated.
It really isn't. Niven, you just, hey, just look at it as that is the fingerprint of the firearm. You pick up shell casing, you put it in the system takes a picture of it, and then when another one's recovered in another crime scene, the system takes a picture of it, and then it kind of gets put together, and now you have a lead. You know, now you have a lead to at least get you started somewhere. So,
well, okay. I'm glad you know how to do that. So what other tools do you use? Not just, I know, fingerprints and this Niven thing. What other tools do you use when you're like an explosive situation? Like what happened in Hershey, Pennsylvania? I'm assuming it's Hershey, Pennsylvania. They had an explosion. Do you go investigate those even though it might be like a gas leak?
Yeah, we'll respond to any explosive incident. We're immediately responding to that because you don't know as soon as it happens, for the most part, what is going on. And then we'll get there and we'll assess, or we'll have our state and local counterparts or our FBI counterparts who also do explosives say, hey, you know, we're on the scene. It was a gas leak, or it was, you know, it wasn't criminal in nature. But when you come across those criminal acts of using explosives, then we get into it. And we have explosive detection canines. So we have dogs that will, and actually my PIO here, Cody Monday, just spent about 18 years in the canine branch. So he's probably more educated on this than I am.
Did you get to keep your dog?
No, I did not.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, but that can find trace amounts, that can smell trace amounts of explosive material, whether that's on a firearm that's been used, whether that's on a shell casing or a bullet, or in this particular instance that we're talking about, in pipe bombs or explosives materials.
And they'll alert to it.
Yeah. And so we have those, and then we have certified explosive specialists. So they go into Huntsville, Alabama, and get a bunch of training, and they come up to date on the latest devices being used and how to render them safe. And we also have bomb techs as well. So you have CES, a certified explosive specialist, and then we have the bomb techs, the guys that actually put on suits. And
I was going to say outfits they wear, they're huge.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You know, and as a matter of fact, just I want to say it was 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, ATF has partnered with the U.S. Army for what we call Raven's Challenge, and we just had that up at Pinal Air Park. And what it is we get these bomb squads from not only across the country, but we were represented by five different nations that came to Pinal Air Park, and we get these bomb techs and we put them through real life scenarios where they can use explosives to countercharge the devices that they find. And the good thing is that you take these bomb techs, and they think they're showing up and they're going to be, all right, this is my team, right? I'm the team. No. So we take those guys and or gals and we match them up with a state and local or another federal agency. And so they have to work together, and then they're sharing ideas and they're sharing methods that they've encountered and devices that they've encountered across the world on how they defeated those certain situations and how they got around them, and they trade ideas, and it's a really great thing.
So. Some really unique situations, and they reenact them.
Yeah, and it's fantastic, and it was something when I was going to the ATF National Academy. You know, I think I was doing really great in the academy until the explosives and the arson block came, and then I realized I wasn't going to be the valedictorian of the class because They're really special people that do that, and they're brilliant, and it's a certain calling to do that. And my career it was not me, but
it wouldn't be me either.
Yeah,
you know what? We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few.
To
report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
There are so many creative scams going on in the Medicare industry that we at Law Matters can barely keep up. We have asked an expert in this arena to filter facts from fiction. If you have questions or concerns, please call Jimmy Stewart at 520-247-2464. He is a licensed professional who can bring clarity to the constant flux in this complex industry. That's Jimmy, 247-2464.
Saving lives means staying informed. Knowing the dangers of using counterfeit prescription pills can help those you care about and keep our community safe. As a parent, educator, neighbor, or friend, we all play a role in building safe and healthy futures for ourselves and our loved ones. Do your part. Take the first step today. Visit GetSmartAboutDrugs.com to access education, prevention, and treatment resources. Counterfeit prescription pills laced with fentanyl are deadly. Be their protector. Be informed. Visit GetSmartAboutDrugs.com.
Law Matters Live Show opens the lines of communication between you and law enforcement. On our next show, Pima County Attorney Laura Conover answers your questions, so get them ready and call in at 790-2040. Law Matters is asking you to help sponsor our mission by contributing on lawmatters1030.org. Every dollar counts, and together we can back the blue while we keep the conversation going. Law Matters podcast can be found on iTunes, Google Play, and lawmatters1030.org. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is ATF Special Agent in Charge, Iber. And we're talking about ATF and pulling back the curtain. We're exposing all the things that they do. Tell us about some of the successful arrests and some of the not-so-successful arrests.
You know, there's been some great cases, and especially since I've been here in May. You know, every day, I will say this, every day we are encountering trafficking, and especially trafficking of firearms into Mexico is a big thing. I have two groups, one in Phoenix and one in Tucson, that their sole mission is dedicated to the southbound trafficking of firearms.
You have an office in Tucson?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, didn't know that.
Okay. So, yeah, so the Phoenix Field Division covers the entire state of Arizona, and then I have the northern half of New Mexico as well. So I have two groups. Now, all my groups do firearms trafficking when they come across it, but two groups solely dedicated to that. And then every day, and we work with Arizona has some of the best law enforcement agencies that I've come across, and I'll say that. Arizona DPS, you know, even our federal partners, HSI, we work very closely with them, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol. Arizona DPS, our state and local partners, you know, it's obviously it's an issue. But every day we are encountering individuals that are having other people go into these gun stores, these FFLs, and lying on the form 4473 to acquire firearms. And they're not only going into FFLs, they're also using, the dark web to contact other folks and acquire the firearms for the sole purpose of bringing them down to Mexico. So, we are coming across that quite a bit. And, you know, sometimes we will make stops and makes arrests, and there's 50 guns in the car, but you know, just one going down south of the border for nefarious purposes is enough. So we come across firearms where there's only one for 50 caliber rifles, you know, but part of our whole success in firearms trafficking and the arrests and the things we get also stems from the cooperation of not only citizens that see this going on, but also your federal firearms licensees. You know, these guys and gals are in the business, that's their livelihood.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't want bad things to happen to their livelihood. That's how they support their families and things like that. And so a lot of them, when they see what they believe to be a straw purchase or other things happening in their gun store, they share that information with us, which is truly appreciated, because the citizens and these guys are and gals are really the first line of defense to shut this down, and we can't do it without them.
Does Mexico have, I know when you come this way you have to declare, does Mexico have that process going into Mexico?
I've never driven into Mexico either, to be honest with you.
So you don't know if you have to declare?
There's some southbound stops that, you know, that can happen, that do happen from time to time. Because Mexico, we're working closely with them. They truly don't want this violence going on in their country either. Their citizens don't want this violence going on in their country. And unfortunately, we're kind of caught in this... I don't want to call it an ecosystem, but, you know, people and illegal narcotics are coming north and firearms are going south, and these firearms are being used by these cartels to maintain their control over certain areas and their routes and things like that. And it's just, it's a vicious cycle. So, you know, it's
difficult because you work with your counterparts and, you know, there is some cooperation on both sides, but then on the news they'll say, you know, okay, don't go to Mexico, it's dangerous, go here and here and here and here, and they'll put a map up of different colors and tell people don't go there.
Right.
And these different sections are owned by different cartel, and some are more dangerous than others. It's confusing. But you do work with your counterparts down in Mexico.
We have to. And the big thing is, if you look at the tracing that Mexico has done, they're increasing their firearms tracing, which helps us on the U.S. side identify some of these straw purchasers and traffickers. So hopefully we do stop quite a few firearms from ever getting Mexico in the first place. And we're not the only ones. Like I said, our state, local, and other federal counterparts are in on this as well.
So you stop somebody and they've got 50 guns in the back of their vehicle.
Yeah.
What do you do with them? You have to hold them. That's evidence. You have to hold them for a court hearing, right?
Sure. And, you know, first we've got to determine, can they legally possess these firearms, and what are these firearms used for? So,
because,
like I said, again, just because...
A hunting trip.
Well, sure. I think we can all agree that there's certain people in society that should never possess firearms or own firearms. But if you can and you're legally allowed to, well, then you can buy as many firearms as you want. And that's not up to me to decide, you know, but that's where the investigation gets started. So we get tips, we get leads, and we make these traffic stops, and let's say there's 50. Well, then the investigation continues until we can determine that these are actually going for nefarious purposes, right? And for the most part, when you come across a carload of 50 firearms that's going south, and, you know, it's for the most part those end up being seized by us, and then we put them into evidence and submit the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office and work really closely with them and continue to build the case and ultimately get these individuals charged.
So does the driver of that car get arrested?
Yes.
Any passengers get arrested?
It depends on how the interview goes and how, you know, and what we can determine at the time, you know. But yes, anybody that we can determine that is involved with the firearms trafficking scheme, then absolutely we're going to arrest those individuals.
So have you had any cases lately there in your career that have been, like, on the news?
Mine, personally?
Yeah.
Since getting into supervision, unfortunately, I don't work too many cases anymore.
It took the fun out of it.
You know, like I said, when I'm sitting on my living room floor at 5 years old wearing a CHIPS helmet and a badge, you know, I never thought that I would be sitting behind a desk, you know, in my law enforcement career and watching all the great men and women in this agency do the work that I used to do. Okay. But you know, so before I actually promoted to supervisor in Oklahoma, I did have a case in Phoenix, and it wasn't firearm trafficking. What I did was basically ran an undercover storefront where we bought over 200 firearms from multiple individuals that shouldn't have had possessed the firearms in the first place, and narcotics, and you know, that made the news, and it was actually at one point in time used, from what I was told, and I don't know if this, I wasn't there, so it was used to brief Congress on how to properly run a storefront.
Well, there you go.
Undercover storefront investigation. So now I'm trying to be. I'm not trying to brag. I you know, I'm sorry.
That's pretty cool.
It was cool. It was really cool. And obviously, it wasn't just me that did it. I was the case agent on it, but I had plenty of partners and help throughout.
It takes a team. Yeah, absolutely, it takes a team. Okay, what is your relationship, your partnership with different, like, state and local law enforcement, county sheriffs, and stuff like that? Do you guys work together on cases?
Absolutely.
So describe it to me.
Sure. We can't do it without them, right? You know, long gone are the days that law enforcement works in silos. And so you have to share information. You have to work together. And, you know, different agencies and different partners have different missions. But if we can all work, we're all here dedicated to keeping our community safe. I think that's the ultimate goal, is to keep community safe. So anytime we can get together and work and combine resources, we absolutely do. And so ATF's big push is getting all of our state and local and federal partners to trace their crime guns when they're recovered, and then also enter their shell casings and their test fires into the NIBIN system for their crime guns and their crime scenes. And right now, if you look at it, Arizona is actually really good as far as tracing firearms. I believe the last thing I saw was about 68% of all law enforcement agencies within the state of Arizona are have e-trace accounts to trace their crime guns. Where if you look nationwide, it's more about 50%. So Arizona's doing fantastic, but we're still constantly trying to educate our state and local partners to trace your firearms, you know, to enter them into NIBIN. We're actually working right now with Arizona HIDA, High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, to make NIBIN machines more readily available throughout the state. So our partners don't have to drive 4 hours to enter it into a machine, that we can get it. We can get the quick entries, therefore we get quick leads out of the information that comes from this too.
What's the cost of that? Is it a software thing, or are you talking physical?
No, it's a physical machine, and basically it's you know, like your old, the best way I can describe it is an old, like, desktop computer.
Okay.
You know, and that's about the size of it, with a screen and things, and you take your shell casing or your test fire shell casing, and you put it into the machine, and it takes a picture of it, a 3D image of all the way around, and then it sends it off to the National Correlation Center, which is in Huntsville, Alabama, and algorithms go through, and it pops up and it says, okay, you have possibly 100 matches, and then you have individuals that sit there and side-by-side comparison these
shell casings. So you still need a human. Just like fingerprints, you still need that Henry glass.
That's correct. And just like anything else, so they just say, hey, this is a potential match, and 90% probability, sometimes higher, that these two match up. So then your investigation starts. And ultimately, when you go to trial, when you go to court to charge these individuals, you still have to have a firearms examiner to come in and do, like you would fingerprints, a certified person to go in there and say, yes, this matches, this shell casing is an exact match. This shell casing came from the same
gun.
Yes, ma'am.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about different job opportunities. Like I said, people think ATF, it's kind of a mystery.
Yeah.
But it's not just special agents.
No.
What all do you hire for?
So obviously special agents, we have the law enforcement side of things, the the badge carrying and the...
And how long does it take to go through training?
So to get hired, you're looking at right now about a year, year and a half from the time that you apply to the time you get hired. And then you have to go to training out at Glencoe, Georgia, at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And that takes about 6.5 months. So you're
looking at 2 years.
Yeah.
And you have to have a college degree?
For the most part, yes, you do. There's some exceptions right now. If you have, I believe it's 3 years of investigative experience, not just patrol officer experience, but you're an actual detective with a state and local.
Or military? Would that count?
No, because you still have to have some investigative experience. If you were...
Military police?
Doing investigations.
Yeah.
Like your OIGs, your Air Force OIG or something like that. Absolutely, that would translate over. And those are 1811, so that's... which 1811 is the job series for special agents. So you have that. You have that side. But for the most part, you do need a college degree to get on with this agency.
Most federal agencies, you have to have a college degree.
Yes, ma'am. There's some exceptions, like I said, but it's very rare. But then you also have, so you have the special agents. And then what we have is we have our industry operation investigators. And those are the regulatory individuals. Those are the ones that go out and are responsible for issuing your federal firearms licensees their license. Do their inspections as well. So they'll go out. They can go out at, once a year, and which it usually isn't once a year, and do an inspection of these federal firearms licensees and make sure they are recording and following the regulations that are set up to operate one of those. We also have federal explosive licensees, which they are the explosives manufacturers. And
do they have stores that...
No, you can't just walk in there and buy some milk and a quarter stick of dynamite or anything that.
But, nothing like that.
But no, I mean, a lot of your mining operations and, you know, your airbags and things like that. Companies like that have to acquire one of these licenses. So,
okay, I didn't know airbags had to have a license.
They use an explosive when they're activated.
Blow up in your face.
To blow up in your face.
Charming. So what is this 101?
Well, that's IOI. That's your industry operation investigator. Not 101. That's the one I was just talking about. There are regulatory folks. They're the ones that go out there and issue the licenses.
See, I thought it was going to be ATF 101.
No.
And then next show it'll be 201.
So that's the two main things. And when I go back and we talked about partnerships with our federal firearms licensees is where we need them. Well, we also regulate those individuals. And so if we do find those bagged actors, which is few and far between, I'll tell you that, then we'll shut them down. And if we can, we'll criminally prosecute them if they were violating the law. But if we can shut them down for if they're not following the rules and regulations that were set up.
Do you ever have a owner of a firearm store have to testify in court that somebody was a straw buyer?
We have had them before. We'll subpoena them. Usually it doesn't get to that, but they have testified before.
Absolutely. Do people just confess to you?
A lot of them do. A lot of them, but a lot of them don't.
Bless me, Father.
a lot of them don't, and that's where the investigation side of things goes.
Do you ever have a case where you've got, like, I know Sierra Vista Police Chief was on, and he was saying that these little kids are being hired to drive, human trafficking type situations. Do you ever have a situation where they hire somebody who really doesn't know what's in the back of the car?
It's very rare.
Yeah.
Very rare. I can't think of a time that we actually had somebody that was driving a carload of firearms around and they said, I had no idea. Now, that happens on the border a lot.
Or in the movies.
Yeah, you do come across that. This is not my car and this is not. And then, HSI is really good at what they do, and so is Customs and Border Protection. They kind of talk to them a little bit and they're like, yeah, they kind of knew what was going on. So
you had a clue.
You know, or the passenger of the car says, I don't know, I was just a passenger. And you find out, when you trace the firearms that they actually purchased the firearms 3 days prior.
And their fingerprints are all over them.
Yeah. So It's all part of the investigative process there, you know. So
where is your career going? If you were going to talk to somebody who is thinking about, you know, getting into law enforcement, what would you recommend for them to do?
I just had this conversation with a young man actually yesterday. We were doing some training on active shooter investigation. If that comes out, we will be responding with our state and local counterparts. And yeah, absolutely. We live in these communities. We want to be safe. And if we hear there's an active shooter at a school or a business, we can't just drive by. We will be responding as well. And we did that quite a bit, unfortunately, in Chicago when I was up there. But I had the conversation with the young man. He wanted to be an agent. He was a college student getting ready to graduate. He actually applied for us. We are accepting applications and I asked him, you know, I kind of explained the year and a half that it would take to get through the process once he's accepted and takes his test. And I told him the best advice I ever got, which we talked about before, was to go be a state and local police officer. And the reason I said that was because that got me. I was able to encounter so many people and learn how to talk to people from all walks of life. You know, growing up in the small town I did in Texas, you know, I didn't encounter everybody
in Chicago, you're encapsulated.
Yeah, so it was great. You learned how to talk to people. You learned how to deal with people and to mitigate situations and stuff. But I also told them the two best agents that I've ever encountered with ATF had no experience whatsoever. So I don't know what that anomaly is. So I tell these people, hey, if ATF's hiring and that's for you, then go and apply. For me, it was going to be a state and local police officer, you know, a local police officer. That was the greatest thing for me personally. But I don't know what makes agents great and what doesn't. What is that one commonality? I don't know what that is, you know. So
it's a calling, I think. It really is. I don't think you can, you know, it's not a job because there's so much more than a job.
Well, it is. It is. And it's a dangerous job. You know, it really is, and it's not for everyone. You know, it's and people have to make that determination. And honestly, when I was at the academy running our basic training, I would talk to the classes and tell them, hey, you know, you made it in. That doesn't mean you're going to finish the academy. Doesn't mean you're going to graduate.
Make it out.
but there's also no shame in if you're getting through this. Going through this training and putting yourself in these scenarios, the explosive, the arson scenarios, the shooting scenarios, the tactical situations that we put everybody in and the laws that we learn and everything. If it's not for you and you determine it's not for you, there's no shame in saying, you know what, this isn't for me. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we're trying to protect. We may have to protect ourselves. We may have to protect our partner. And we're always trying to protect the citizens that don't deserve this violence that is going on in the neighborhoods. And if we're not prepared to do that, then maybe there's another job for you.
Break down the training for me. I know a lot of it's physical.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. You have to do a lot of push-ups. You have to do a lot of running.
You got to do a lot of push-ups. You got to do a lot of running. And when I went through...
walls.
When I went through, you had to do a lot of long distance running, and that was not my forte, to be honest with you. I struggled with that a little bit. I played football in high school, and I could run short distances, but the long distance was never my thing. So, very physically demanding.
Look like a football player.
So, very physically demanding, but then you're also sitting in class 8-10 hours a day, and you're going in, like I said, you're learning the laws. You're living on that base. You're in dorms. You're being fed there and you're living on that base, but then you have firearms ranges, you know, you're learning how to shoot, and then you have your tactical situations where you're going into houses and learning how to clear buildings and stuff when you're serving search warrants.
Do they have a Hogan's Alley?
Yes, they do. Okay. And I would have to say it rivals that place. It's called Danis City out there, and it's a fantastic place.
A little competition,
you know. But I've never visited Hogan's Alley, so I wouldn't know. But you know, and then you also have, you know, when we get to the explosives block, we are learning how to we'll blow up vehicles. We'll actually put explosives devices in vehicles, blow them up, and the agents have to go out there and pick up all these little tiny pieces and reconstruct what just happened. And so you're out there, and like I said, 6.5 months of that, and then your arson, we're actually burning. We have burn cells where we burn down, let's just say, an apartment.
Stuff.
And you have to go in there, and you're trying to determine where the fire started, and using all of our different tools to figure that out. So there's real life scenarios and practical exercises. And
so does each element have a certain number of weeks you train for that element? So if you want to specialize like in explosives, is that another school outside of?
So sure. We give you basic knowledge during the academy of everything.
Right.
You know, and then when you actually come out to the field, we expect you on the agent side to be an agent, be an investigator. And usually for agents, about 5 years is when you can start looking into some of these specialties. And so
it's not right away.
No, ma'am. It sure isn't. So if you want to be a certified explosive specialist or a bomb tech, well, then you start applying and then you're getting your master's degree. You know, it's 3 years of schooling for certified explosive specialists. We're certified fire investigators is another 3 years. If you want to be a fire investigator, you know, if you want to join our SRT team, which is our SWAT team, you go through a bunch of training. We have advanced undercover schools for our undercover agents that want to continue to learn how to do undercover and a bunch of other things. So
do they, if you have a college degree, let's say you have your bachelor's degree and you want to continue, do they help pay for your education, or are these classes you're talking about applied to a master's degree?
Yeah, so yes, you will get a master's degree in some of those, and ATF actually does pay for, there's certain master's degree programs that ATF will put you through, like the Army War College and things like that. But if you just wanted to go out and get a master's degree and didn't apply through ATF, they wouldn't reimburse you for that.
Oh, so you have to know that in advance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if people are interested in becoming an ATF special agent, or actually any job, they have all kinds of jobs.
Yeah, we do. So we have special agents. We have the IOIs we talked about. We have intel research specialists, intel analysts. We have NIBIN contractors, individuals putting shell casings into
crime lab.
Crime labs, you know.
Where's your crime lab?
Well, we have three of them.
You can talk, Cody.
Atlanta, California,
and Maryland.
And Maryland. Thank you, Cody. Thank you.
He's writing as fast as he can. So you know, people can get hired to work in a crime lab.
Absolutely. And so if you go on usajobs.gov, right now we have an open announcement for 1811s, which is the special agent job series. We have an open announcement for 1801s, which is our industry operation investigators. But I think right now that's just a Schedule A, which is a disability, you know, military disability. It's geared towards vets, towards veterans, you know, and so I think, but I'd have to double check on that. Don't hold me accountable for that. But
I'm going to hold you accountable.
Yeah. you know, and to be honest with you, pretty soon, headquarters tells me within a week or two, we will be opening up a job announcement for our intel research specialist for Tucson, Phoenix, Flagstaff, and Albuquerque.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you're hiring.
We're hiring.
And to get a job like that doesn't take a year and a half, or do they all go through the same year and a half? I know they talk to everybody in your history, your kindergarten teacher on up.
Yeah, you have to get a top secret clearance for us. And so really the drawn out process is that background. You know, your polygraph and your background takes a long time to be able to attain that top secret clearance level. You know, so... But yeah, but usually your intel research specialist is, you're not doing the physical fitness test, you're not doing the written exam, and so yeah, so some take longer than others. The agent position takes the longest.
Okay, so if you go to usajobs.gov, you can apply to be an ATF agent or other positions that they have open.
Yes, ma'am.
So I want to thank you for being here, coming all the way down from Phoenix.
No, thank you so much.
And Cody, thank you for putting this together. Enjoy your time at the air show. It's going to be awesome. And until next week, I want everybody to shop local, stay safe. And if you take your dog to the air show, don't lock him in your car. The military police will come after you, and they're not kidding. Trust me. Law Matters Live Show opens the lines of communication between you and law enforcement. On our next show, Pima County Attorney Laura Conover answers your questions, so get them ready and call in at 790-2040. Law Matters is asking you to help sponsor our mission by contributing on lawmatters1030.org. Every dollar counts, and together we can back the blue while we keep the conversation going. Law Matters podcast can be found on iTunes, Google Play, and lawmatters1030.org.
KVOI Cortero, AM 1030, the voice of Tucson. Trusted local news and talk. A Bustos Media Station.